A New York Times CBS poll taken in February found a majority of Americans favor a government guarantee of health insurance, even if it means higher taxes. My guest Jonathan Cohn has written a new book exploring the need for health care reform and options for achieving it. The book is an argument for universal health care, told mostly in the form of individual stories, not of the desperately poor, but of working people, many educated and enterprising, whose families were financially ruined and emotionally devastated by illnesses that were uncovered or undercovered by the current health insurance system. Jonathan Cohn is a senior editor at The New Republic and a contributing editor at The American Prospect. His book is called Sick: The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Let's look at some of the case studies that you share with us that illustrate weaknesses or problems in American healthcare. Now, one problem is insurance companies denying coverage or overpricing coverage to people with the very health conditions that make insurance critical for them. And you excite the example of a woman named Janice Ramsey. What's her story?
We catch up with Janice in a little after 2001, 2002. And Janice has built herself a very nice business. She's a consultant working with some realty companies. And she's also taking care of her mother, who's sick at the same time. Her problem is that she has diabetes. Now, if you are part of a large group insurance plan, that shouldn't make too much of a difference, because in a large group, they'll take anybody and they will price everybody at the same price, and that's fine. But when you try to apply for insurance on your own or as part of a small business, the insurance industry will want to know, well, what kind of conditions do you have that we're going to be insuring? And if they discover that you have something like diabetes, which she does, then they are going to be very wary of providing that coverage. And in fact, she tried very hard to find coverage, and every policy that came back was either denied outright, or sometimes they would tell her, well, we'll give you the coverage, we just won't cover anything related to your diabetes. Now, if you know anything about diabetes, you know that pretty much almost any medical problem in the world could be plausibly blamed on diabetes. So she did the math and said, well, gee, this isn't really going to cover anything for me. And so she didn't go for any of those plans, and that sort of set her up for the next stage of what was going to happen to her.
Which was what?
Well, as often happens, people in that situation find themselves pretty desperate to find an insurance policy that works. So one day, along comes this insurer with a very nice-sounding insurance plan. She lives in Central Florida, and they're hooked into the best networks of doctors and hospitals in the area. She looks over the plan. This looks great. And the best part is they say they would charge her an affordable premium, and they won't exclude her pre-existing conditions. So she is just ecstatic. She signs up for the plan. They start withdrawing the premiums. And she thinks everything is fine until a few months later she has to go to the hospital for something. And she gets taken care of. She goes home. And a few months after that, she starts getting calls from the hospital. The bill hasn't been paid. Well, she figures there must have been some mix-up. So she calls up the insurer, and they say, oh, yes, 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 we're just reviewing the claim. So she doesn't think anything of it. Well, a little more time passes. The bill still hasn't been paid. She finally complains to the state, and that's when she finds out that, in fact, her insurer was a fraudulent insurer, and she's been paying premiums to this scam all along. And this actually turns out to be a very common problem. There are literally millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in premiums were paid to fraudulent insurers, many of them doing exactly what this insurer did, which is targeting people who can't find affordable coverage in the small business market or the individual insurance market. And then what happens is these people buy the insurance, and then they suddenly find themselves uninsured, and they really have the worst of all worlds. Now they're stuck with medical bills that aren't covered because, of course, they don't have insurance now to cover them. They can't buy insurance because now they have these pre-existing conditions. And so they end up with medical debts, health problems, and really nothing they can do about it.
So the problem here is people who don't get health insurance from their work, often people who are self-employed. And do insurance companies have complete discretion to deny them coverage or price it so high that it's unaffordable?
Well, different states have different laws, but the fundamental problem here is in the absence of a universal health care system, there's no way to force an insurance company to insure somebody who has these conditions. And when you think about it, in fairness to the insurance companies, they have a good reason for not wanting to insure these people. The old Blue Cross plans, originally they would insure everybody. They offered coverage to everybody. And what ended up happening was eventually other commercial insurance companies came into the business and started picking off the healthiest consumers and charging them lower rates. And what ended up happening was Blue Cross got stuck with all the very sick patients. They had to raise their premiums in order to cover those costs, and then they started losing customers. So for an insurance company operating in a competitive marketplace, there just isn't any way to make money if you're not ruthless about who you cover and who you don't.
Are companies getting more aggressive about seeking to determine what pre-existing conditions might exist? I mean, there's a lot of information out there for people who are aggressive about getting it.
That's right. I mean, they've always been aggressive about that. The change is now is that there's more. They have more information at their disposal. And really looking ahead, I think one of the most worrisome trends is the development of genetic technology. Now, we think of unlocking the genome as this great potential for medical breakthroughs, and it is. We might be able to cure all sorts of things. We can screen people for conditions before they develop them. I mean, that is a wonderful medical tool. The problem is that insurance companies can use those tools too, and they can find out that, oh, gee, you're at risk for getting breast cancer, or you're at risk for developing diabetes. Well, they find that out, and they either will jack up your rates or they won't cover you at all. And in fact, there's already been a study out there that has suggested that there are women not taking the genetic test for breast cancer precisely because they fear someday that information might fall into the hands of insurance companies. And that's, to me, a classic example of the way our system, the way it is structured, actually works across purposes with what we want in terms of public health.
You know, I think a lot of people who have health insurance or at least haven't experienced a health financial crisis assume that when people can't afford care, it will be provided and then somebody will absorb the cost. I mean, if you check into a hospital, they will treat you, and if you can't pay, they absorb the cost.
Well, first of all, there are two fallacies with that statement. The first is that it is not true you can always get medical care if you can't afford it. Hospitals will see you if you have an emergency. They are required by federal law to do so. But good luck trying to get preventative care or any kind of non-essential emergency care. That's a whole other story. So people who don't have insurance often have trouble getting access to preventative care, which of course then leads to emergencies down the road. The second problem is that even when they do treat you, they will treat you. They will stabilize you. They will make you better. And they will send you home. And then they will expect to be paid. Now, there is a great controversy over how much they can expect to be paid and what efforts they should make to help you find assistance. But there are documented cases all over the place where people go into the hospital, they don't have health insurance, they get the emergency stabilizing care they need, they go home, and the next thing they know is they owe bills that are five or even six figures. And if they can't pay them off, sometimes they are lucky and they can get taken under the wing by a state agency, or maybe the hospital will write off their charges bad debt. But a lot of times, the hospitals will farm out the collections of these to collections agencies.
My guest is Jonathan Cohn. His new book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Well, let's talk about some of the difficult policy issues that we confront if we talk about addressing the problem of insuring the uninsured in America. Now, one argument that you hear against a national health insurance program is that private enterprise can simply do things better. Government bureaucrats will find ways to waste money and provide shoddy care, but you know, an organization that has to meet a bottom line is going to do a better job. What do you think of that argument?
Well, that is one of the most powerful arguments that has been used historically against universal health care. I like to think we've had basically an 80-year running experiment to test this. And the experiment has been, this is basically how we run our healthcare system. And if you can compare how our private health insurance system has worked against other countries that have universal health care, or if you want to compare it even in this country, compare the performance of private insurance versus our best public insurance program, Medicare, I think the evidence is overwhelming that the private sector simply doesn't do this better. The basic problem here is that at some fundamental level, you cannot make money by taking really good care of people who are sick, and you will not make money by helping people who don't have enough money to get their health care afford it. These are not ways that you can make a profit. And the private market, that's what the private market tries to do. It tries to make a profit. And I think our 80-year experiment in this has shown that fundamentally the private sector, the private market, doesn't work very well at providing health insurance. And frankly, there's a good reason to believe the government could do it better.
Now, you say that a simple argument for universal health care comes when you compare what the United States spends on its health care and the results it gets to what other nations spend and their results. What do you find?
Well, again, this is pretty unambiguous. We by far spend more on healthcare as a percentage of our wealth than any other developed country in the world. And yet we do not have better results to show for it. Health indicators, you know, if you want to look at very crude indicators, how long do we live? What is the infant mortality rate? That sort of thing. We don't do better there. If you want to look more closely at statistics, there are various statistics people have come up with, like potential years of life lost, which are really an effort to zero in on the effect of the healthcare system and sort of void out things like, well, do we have higher poverty here and such. Again, we don't do any better, and in some ways we do a little worse. And even if you look at things like at what rate do we cure various diseases, this is an argument you hear a lot of coming from conservatives who oppose universal health care, and they will point out to one or two diseases where the United States does better. Well, yeah, there are some where the United States does better. There's also some where the United States does worse. And if you look at the evidence as a whole, if you look at the crude indicators, the good indicators, I think it is virtually impossible for anybody with intellectual honesty to make the case that our system is better. And yet we're spending all this extra money. And that's just talking about health outcomes. And let's not forget the fact that other countries don't have this situation where there are major financial barriers to medical care. You don't have masses of people filing for bankruptcy because of their medical debts. You don't have all sorts of people making trade-offs like they do here between, can I afford my rent or am I going to pay for my drugs? You just don't see that in those other countries. And you look at that evidence, you see all the extra money we're spending, and I think you have to ask, how on earth could you say this is a better system?
Well, one of the things that opponents of national health care say is that we're wasting a fortune on malpractice assurance because of out-of-control jury settlements. How much of a drain is that on the system?
Well, there is a separate conversation to be had about the malpractice system. I don't happen to like our malpractice system, and there are, I think, some smart ways we could reform it. But if you're trying to ask the question, as you just did, does malpractice insurance drive up the cost of health care? Every study looking at this has suggested it has a minimal impact.
The other argument against a national healthcare system you hear is people will drag up some horror stories from Canada or Great Britain of long waits for care and shoddy treatment. What stock do you place in those stories?
I actually think this is probably one of the most powerful arguments against universal healthcare politically. And there are a few points to be made here. First of all, there are waiting lines in some other countries with universal healthcare. Now, those countries spend a lot less than we do. If they spent closer to what we did, they probably wouldn't have such long waiting lines. In addition to that, and purely in terms of health outcomes, it may be that people are waiting for treatment. There's nothing in the statistics to suggest a place like Canada is really suffering serious adverse health effects from it. Again, that's opposed to the United States, where there's a large body of evidence to suggest that people who don't have health insurance are suffering severe medical consequences. We don't see that, at least to that extent, with countries like Canada. But the most important point I like to stress is that there are a lot of countries with universal health care that don't have rationing and waiting problems like we do here. If you go to France or you go to Germany or Japan, all the evidence compiled by the big international authorities like the OECD or the World Health Organization, they don't have waiting problems there. They, in fact, in many ways, they get more health care than we do. They have better access to health care than we do. Americans sometimes like to think, oh, gee, if we have universal health care, we won't have all the high-tech gizmos we want. Well, it's not entirely clear that we actually benefit from having all those high-tech gizmos. But quite apart from that, people who say that should know that we are not the country in the world that has the most MRI machines and CT scanners. That distinction belongs to Japan, and Japan has universal health insurance. So this idea that if we have universal health care, then we're going to have rationing and all be waiting for our doctors, it just isn't true. There are, in fact, countries that have both universal health care and free access to medicine, frankly, freer than we have here.
So do you think the climate has shifted here? I mean, is the groundwork there for a successful movement for universal health care?
The conditions on the ground are shifting. This problem is getting worse. It is worse now than it was 10 years ago. It is going to keep getting worse, and it might start to get worse at an accelerating pace. But I think at this point, there's a lot more work to be done explaining not just what's going on, but why it's happening. And people need to understand that this isn't some complicated problem that nobody can fix. It's actually a very fixable problem. We just need the will to do it.
You know, a number of states are experimenting with efforts to provide universal health coverage. Massachusetts has gotten a lot of attention. I mean, I wonder how – do you regard these as distractions from a needed national effort, or are they maybe laboratories where you can see what works and steps towards a real reform?
I think they are, in general, going to move us closer to universal health care, if only by political example. I think it is highly significant right now that we have two states, one that has passed a universal health care plan and one that is actively talking about creating a universal health care plan.
Let's just be clear. We're talking about Massachusetts and
California.
Right, right.
So now, admittedly,
Pennsylvania is also talking about some major steps too. But go ahead. Yeah.
Sure. Yes. No. The states are busy working on this. But to me, I think the Romney and Schwarzenegger examples are really the most vivid because I think they create political room for this discussion. I mean, it was not that long ago when to even talk about universal health care was considered out of bounds. And even in the 2004 presidential election, when most of the Democrats were promising universal health care, with the exception of Dennis Kucinich, none of them were actually offering a plan that would have actually achieved universal health care. So now that has changed, and I don't think it's coincidental that now that Romney and Schwarzenegger have put this on the table, that we see this flurry of activity now. We have private sector interests. We have the Business Roundtable. We have the CEO of Safeway, people like that. Everyone's coming out for universal health care. So politically, I think it certainly advances the cause. Now, whether as policy that helps, that's a much harder question. It is very hard in general to do this on a state-by-state level. California might have a better luck at it than a lot of states simply because it's so big that it has a certain leverage with the insurance industry that other states wouldn't. And they are also, Massachusetts and California are also both trying out this model which is called an individual mandate. And this has become a very popular model for doing universal health care right now. The idea of an individual mandate, the phrase comes from the idea that we are mandating or requiring individuals to buy insurance, to buy private insurance. Some people might still be eligible for programs like Medicaid, which you can keep in place. But the general idea is that we're saying, look, we want everybody in the system, and we're going to make you be in the system the same way that you have to buy auto insurance if you want to drive a car. Well, if you want to live in our state, you have to buy health insurance. Now, if you get it through your employer, that's fine. If you don't, then you have to buy it on your own. And the state then turns around and says, we understand that it's hard to buy insurance sometimes. Sometimes it won't be available to you because of your health conditions, and sometimes you simply won't be able to afford it. So in exchange for requiring you to buy insurance, we will, number one, make sure that there is insurance available to you. We will make sure that even if you have diabetes or you're a cancer survivor, that you can still buy insurance at a reasonable rate. And number two, if you're poor or even not that poor, but you find insurance hard to pay for, we're going to give you subsidies so that you can afford it. And that's the sort of two-way street. You know, you're required to do this. We, in return, will do that. And that is the basic idea behind the individual mandate.
And the drawbacks are?
Well, the drawbacks are it is very easy to say we're going to make affordable insurance available to you. The problem they're running into in Massachusetts is that it's a lot harder to do that in practice. The insurance companies will want to be paid a certain amount of money. The state will want not to spend more money than it has to on subsidizing people. There's only so much money going around. So there, you would end up inevitably in a very complicated discussion about, well, what should we require people to have? How much should we expect them to pay for it? And how do we actually make this all work? Again, this experiment is ongoing, so I hesitate to say it will or won't work. I think it's very interesting to watch, and I'm actually glad the states are trying this out because I do think this is a case where, quite honestly, the lessons we see in Massachusetts and California, should they pass this kind of law, would actually be helpful on a national level.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Jonathan Cohn's new book is Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price.